see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
It may not always seem that way, but it is a wonderful world, a world of possibilities. I'm Mary Muckle.
And I'm Elena Banta. During this hour, we share information on a variety of topics such as science and technology, finance, nutrition, health, entertainment, the arts, and current events. Today, we'll talk about electoral politics, an amazing symbiotic relationship between two friends. We'll offer some thoughts on raising an autistic child and some interesting information about the rapper Drake. We'll have prose and poetry by Guy Wetmore Carroll, William Blake, Woody Allen, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, Dorothy Parker, and H.H. Monroe, otherwise known as Saki. We'll also have another episode of Mary's World and the misadventures of Mrs. Ambrose, church organist. And last, but certainly not least, we'll have some jokes and a variety of silliness to leave you laughing. Also, at the end of the show, we'll give you a telephone number to call so that you can give us some feedback. Sound good? Stay tuned.
I'm always wondering how rich people made their money. I have an article called From Drump to Trump, How Donald Trump Got to Be Rich. And it's from The Week magazine, the March 26, 2016 issue. Okay, From Drump to Trump. How did Rick make his money? He arrived in New York City in 1885 at age 16, hoping to make his fortune. Friedrich had grown up in Karlstadt, a small village in southwestern Germany, where the locals are called Brautmacher or Braggarts. His ancestral name was Drumpf, and that's D-R-U-M-P-F, but the name was changed in the 17th century, possibly to improve the family's social status. After a few years working as a barber in New York City, Friedrich moved to Seattle, anglicized his first name to Frederick, and opened a small establishment in the city's red light district. He offered customers round-the-clock access to food, liquor, and private rooms for ladies, code for prostitutes. Was the brothel a success? It was, and the ambitious Trump decided to take his services where the money was, relocating to the Yukon to take advantage of the Klondike gold rush. In this saloon-com brothels there, the bedrooms had scales so customers could pay for services with gold dust. In 1901, the regional police chief ordered a crackdown on gambling, liquor sales, and scarlet women. Trump fled back to New York with a nice nest egg. During a visit home to Karlstadt, he got engaged to a local woman, Elizabeth Christ, and tried to resettle in Germany. But the authorities deported him for dodging military service during his years in America. So the couple moved to New York, and when Frederick died at age 49 from Spanish flu in 1918, it was his son who continued the family's legacy. In what way? Fred set up a garage construction business with his mother when he was still in high school. Elizabeth Trump and Son was a huge success, and in the 1920s, the budding real estate mogul began building single-family houses in the borough of Queens. He was notoriously frugal, known for walking around his construction sites picking up dropped nails. In 1936, Trump married a Scottish immigrant named Mary Ann McLeod. The couple's five children included Mary Ann, now a senior federal appeals court judge, and Donald. After World War II, Trump Sr. took advantage of large federal housing grants to build rental apartments complexes in Brooklyn and Queens. Realizing that his German heritage might be a hindrance to business, he claimed his parents were Swedish. He had a lot of Jewish tenants, explained his nephew John Walter. It wasn't a good thing to be German in those days. How wealthy was he? By the 1970s, Fred was a multimillionaire. When he died in 1999, he was worth as much as $3 million. But Fred's career wasn't without controversy, particularly on racial matters. He was arrested in Queens in 1927 after a street battle at a Ku Klux Klan rally. In 1973, the family firm and Donald Trump himself were sued by the Justice Department for allegedly discriminating against black people who wanted to rent apartments. The applications of blacks, an investigation had found, were marked with a C for colored and were declined. The company eventually settled and agreed to put in place anti-discrimination measures. How did Donald make his money? He left Brooklyn and Queens behind and set out to make it big in the more glamorous environs of Manhattan. "I had loftier dreams and visions," he said. Only 3 years after graduating from college, Trump took out a $1 million loan from his father and more than $100 million in bank loans his father helped secure for him and leveraged it into a string of major building projects in Manhattan, including the Grand Hyatt Hotel, Trump Tower, and Trump Plaza. He also branched out into golf courses, luxury resorts, and dozens of other industries. A natural showman, Trump, who was originally told people he was Swedish, understood the value of marketing himself. "If I take out a full-page ad in the New York Times to publicize a project, it might cost $40,000, he said in 1987. "But if the New York Times writes even a moderately positive one-column story about one of my deals, it doesn't cost me anything." Has he made any bad deals? Many. He bought a team in the upstart United States Football League, then helped bring about the league's collapse by moving its season to compete head-to-head with the NFL's. His Atlantic City casinos led to four company bankruptcies, almost wiping out his entire personal fortune. Thousands of former students are suing the now-defunct Trump University, in which New York State officials called a classic bait-and-switch scheme.
Okay.
Yep.
It's one way of making money.
That's our boy.
Yeah, that's our boy, right?
Okay. Moving on. It doesn't happen often, but every now and then you hear a story about two best friends who function as one person to overcome all odds to help others. This is a story about a blind man and his armless best friend. The story is from the website One Green Planet, and it was written by Kate Good. The story is about Gia Haxia and Gia Wenke. These are two 53-year-old men from China who have faced incredible challenges in their lives. Haxia was born with congenital cataracts that caused him to be blind in one eye. He then lost sight in his one good eye after a work accident in 2000. Wenke tragically lost both of his arms in an accident when he was only 3 years old and has been living as a double amputee ever since. Despite their physical setbacks, Haxia and Wenke have remained utterly determined to live life to the fullest. These two best friends help one another navigate the world, and when they're together, there's nothing that they cannot do. Adding to their amazing story of friendship is the fact that the pair have managed to plant over 10,000 trees over the course of the past 10 years. "I am his hands," said Haxia. "He is my eyes. We are good partners." The pair met in 2001 when they were both struggling to find work because of their disabilities. Neither wanted to give up on life, so they hatched a plan to plant trees to earn money. By planting trees, they could give back to the community and ensure a better future for others. With this idea in mind, they set out to lease 3 acres of land from the government and got to work. Haxia and Wenke rise every day at 7 a.m. and set out to plant trees. When they reach the busy stream they need to cross to get to their site, Wenke carries Haxia to the other side. Money is tight, but the pair are determined to reforest their land. Unable to buy new saplings, they use cuttings from older trees to sprout new life. When it comes time to scale trees to collect cuttings, Renki carefully directs Haxia, acting as his eyes. The work requires much patience, and the fruits of their labors are not always apparent. But seeing young saplings grow inch by inch is enough to bring Haxia and Renki peace of mind. We stand on our own feet. The fruits of our labor taste sweeter. Even though we are gnawing on steam buns, we find peace in our hearts. A number of generous people have volunteered to help Haxia and Renki after hearing their story. One kind benefactor has offered to pay for a surgery that could help restore Haxia's sight, and another has donated money toward their pensions to ensure that they always have a roof over their heads and enough food to eat. Isn't it amazing to see one kind action turn into countless others? Okay.
Some story. Very amazing.
Yeah.
It makes you want to do more for people.
I know.
Yeah. I don't want to think about that.
Okay.
Okay. And from Parent Magazine, September 20th, 2016 issue, this article is written by Jennifer Wood, who is an attorney that specializes in family and special needs children. She herself has an autistic son, and this article is how he taught her his definition of friendship. And it's called King for a Day. My son may not know how fantastic it is when this happens, but I do. I wish to congratulate every parent of each kid who was kind to my son, who is pretty perceptibly autistic, and thank them for raising such cool people. Don't get me wrong, my son is definitely deserving of their attention and affection. He's sweet, funny, and smart. Once more, he authentically enjoys all of the other people in his path every day. He wants to connect with them. He wants to hang out with them. He wants to be friends with them. Only he doesn't have any friends. My son once told me that he wanted to run for class president because he's popular at school. I don't doubt this. He's well-liked, and he might be just that kid you see on Facebook who gets elected prom king or something for being so well-supported by his peers. And in that moment, I would be happy for him because something like that would be truly special. But it wouldn't last. The memory would be rich and decadent as far as adolescent goes. My son would be king for a day, but would only be for a day, and I know that. And he would have friends that day, that week, that month, that year, maybe. But they would not be real friends. They might enjoy being part of that moment, helping my son succeed. After all, kids do some pretty terrific stuff when we let them. But even if he was a prom king, my son still would have no actual friends. His acquaintances would text one to another to find out where they're going on Friday night, who just broke up with who, and where to find the next pickup basketball game. But no one will text my son. After all, he probably won't be able to drive himself anywhere on a Friday night ever. He's not interested in dating that I know of, and he still prefers Minecraft to hoops. The difference between kindness and friendship became clear at my son's IEP meeting this year, when his teachers and team noted there's a tremendous difference between being liked and having friends. But I'll take well-liked, and I'll take nice all day long. I'm a school law attorney, and I feel calls about bullying every single day, so I'll gladly welcome kindness even in the guise of friendship. But still, my son never gets invited to birthday parties anymore or to the movies with his friends. He is well-liked, and people are very, very kind to him. But he has no real friends, and that makes me feel helpless and depressed. Or at least it used to. Recently, my kids and I went on an adventure with some friends, another mom and her boys. It was a dazzling, brilliant experience. But I noticed that one of the kids was texting about teenage stuff and that my son was trying to connect with him on a whole different level, a more juvenile one. The other young man was experiencing life exactly that, a young man. Yet my son was still interacting with him as a child. I quickly realized that this young man cared about my son, but may never be his friend. And I was wrong. The next week, my son went to therapy, as he does nearly every day, and told his speech therapist all about his weekend away. I went with Danny, and he is my best friend in the whole world. So my son does have friends. He may not share the same definition of friendship that I envision for a teenage boy, but all of these awesome kids are still friends to him. They may not text him about girls or basketball, but that is because they know he does not care about girls or basketball. And as I came out to find out, they do text him. He just doesn't text them back because his social skills are still a work in progress. I have quickly realized that my definition of friendship needs to change. Friends are friends in many different ways. If my son interprets kindness as friendship, that means my boy is rich with friends, his friends, according to his definition of friendship. When my son looks in the mirror, he is smiling, he is happy, and I am happy.
Wow. Boy, that is beautiful. Oh, okay. Does it seem like political campaigns are getting nastier by the day? A lot of folks are opting out of the whole process. I'd like to read an article from the September 23rd, 2016 issue of The Week magazine entitled Why Voting Isn't for Everyone. It was written by Jeff Jacoby for the Boston Globe. You don't vote? Nothing wrong with that, said Jeff Jacoby. Tens of millions of Americans don't cast ballots in our national election, and they generally have a good reason for abstaining. Voting is like owning a gun or attending a church or pledging loyalty to a candidate or party. The Constitution guarantees that you have a right to do these things, but it also guarantees your right not to do these things. Personally, I like the communal spirit of voting and to see it as an act of faith in democracy. I also give a lot of time and thought to candidates and policy, but lots of Americans find politics and government repugnant and don't follow news coverage of campaigns. Whatever the reason, they're uninformed, so why hector them to vote? This is not a partisan issue. In his latest book, former NBA superstar Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, now a liberal commentator, says that when we pressure low-information voters to cast ballots, we're diluting the democratic process by bringing out those who are easily manipulated. Right he is. Even if do-gooders, busybodies, and community organizers insist that everyone should vote, staying away from the polls is a legitimate option. So that doesn't speak very well for our democracy, but...
No, it doesn't, but people, they have the option not to vote, too, I guess. Some just don't.
Okay. What's next?
I have an article about the rapper Drake, and you're going to see his personality and his music in this article, and it's called The Self-Conflict Zone. The Toronto rapper and his singer Drake got his big break in 2009, back when describing someone as both a rapper and a singer still seemed like a way to undermine his credibility. That year, he released So Far Gone, a mixtape that showcased him as a one-man distillation of modern hip-hop and R&B. In the past, the impassive outlaw rapper and the gushing doe-eyed singer crossed paths only as a way of combining their genres' respective charms for his hit single. Drake cracked the code. He collapsed the distance between these archetypes, seeming equally comfortable, rhyming about dodging bullets and bearing his insecurities in a come-hither hook. There have been artists before him, like Lauryn Hill and Missy Elliott, who toggled between rapping and singing. But what distinguished Drake was a sense of shameless guile, a confidence in his complex persona that was due partly to his background as an actor. Under his birth name, Aubrey Graham, he played a basketball star on Degrassi's The Next Generation. As with his predecessor, Kanye West, there was something novel about a male rapper who appeared to be so sensitive. Since the success of So Far Gone, Drake has become one of pop music's most polarizing figures, as well as one of its most influential. He is like an algorithm circling through a set of durable themes. Nobody believed in me. Always be loyal. My enemies are out to get me. We should be together. I've tried to be faithful, but I can't. And above all, nobody's perfect. The last motif has defined Drake's growth as an artist, starting with Ornate Melancholia of Take Care from 2011. Drake elevated onto the unfurling of one's imperfections into an art form. It wasn't just his interest in scrutinizing his own contradictions, by now a trope for any thoughtful rapper. It was the harshness of his raps and the unabashed softness of his singing, the way his music fitted between styles and rhythms, expressing a restless desire to become someone or something better. The music sounded intimate and precise, owing largely to a close-knit circle of producers, led by his friend Noah Shabib, who swaddled his voice within their digital purrs and tolling bells. The thing about introspection, though, is that it allows us to think ourselves always as a work in progress. While this is a healthy realization with which to greet every day, it doesn't make for the most compelling narrative. In recent years, Drake has grown perhaps too comfortable in this perceptual state of self-examination and light sadness. He bleeds onto the page and then admires a pattern he leaves behind. He minds his past, not as a reason to change, but as a rationalization for his worst behavior. Last month, Drake released his fourth album, Views. On the cover, he poses high up on Toronto's CN Tower, an apt if melodramatic image of loneliness at the top. All of my let's just be friends are friends I don't have anymore, he croons. Keep the Family Close, one of the many songs on the album which functions as autopsies for relations past. Maybe there was something there. Probably not, he concludes, comparing a certain woman to a Chrysler designed to fool passersby into thinking it's a Bentley. It's well, quite the guy. Huh?
Yeah, he's interesting. Interesting yeah, fellow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's always something going on in your world, Mary. What have you got for us today?
Okay. Everything was on an even keel with my brother till my brother told me he had met a nice girl and they were coming here to visit. They wanted to come this weekend, but I asked him if they would mind coming next Saturday. No way could I clean up my house that fast. Housekeeper, I'm not. I have a lot of hobbies, so doing these have become priorities. Putting stuff back in order is not a priority. I am not a good organizer. When I try to put things away by separating them, they seem to end up almost back in the same file or place. Then I get frustrated, and they end up thrown together in one big bag or bin anyway. My one project to make things look better was to try to get a new sofa. I tried three different places, and friends had suggested. I didn't find anything. Maybe my tastes are out of style. Maybe at my age you should try an antique shop. I might have better luck. When I was thinking what to do about this dilemma, one of my husband's friends happened to call. Somehow we got on the subject of sofas. He had the same problem. After he ran around all over the place, he found a furniture maker and custom ordered what he wanted. Sounds like a pretty good idea to me. Maybe I'll give that a try. Why not?
Why not, yeah, indeed?
Yeah.
Okay. And
okay.
What's happening with Mrs. Ambrose these days?
Misadventures of poor Mrs. Ambrose, church organist. This is rally day, the beginning of the new Sunday school year at St. Do-Right's Reformed Again, and Continuously Reformed Church. The church will be starting a new agenda this year. This year, the children will stay for half the adult service, then will be dismissed for Sunday school for the rest of the time. Mrs. Ambrose has a gleam in her eye as she knows the Cooper twins, Billy and Frankie, now 11, won't have so much time for church pranks. Mrs. Ambrose has chosen Morning Has Broken for the opening hymn. She's having a little trouble playing the G and A notes on the right hand of the organ because they've been glued together. The G note on the left hand sticks, so she has to pound it hard for sound. So now the first hymn is sounding like a blues or a rock song. Pastor Johnson and the choir march down the aisle. Three-fourths of the way down, Pastor Johnson trips on an invisible string and falls forward, with the rest of the choir falling down on top of him like a deck of cards one on top of another. Some people stumble around and grab the end of a pew, not falling. Regaining their dignity, they regroup into the choir loft. Pastor Johnson gives a quick prayer that no one got hurt. Billy Cooper, one of the twins, has his face buried in the hymnal. Margaret, the Sunday school superintendent, goes up front to pass out attendance awards. Of course, she calls up Billy and Frankie first. The only time they ever missed was when they had the chicken pox. There are 20 kids in the Sunday school. They each get a little gift from their teacher. The kids, in turn, give pretty bouquets of flowers to their teachers. In a surprise, Mrs. Ambrose gets a bouquet from everyone in the church and beams from ear to ear. The service continues. Pastor Johnson makes announcements, and they say some creeds. Someone has turned the ceiling fans up because the temperature has gone up and the church is somewhat stuffy. The choir gets up to sing the anthem, "Go Forth, Bright Light." In the middle of the second verse, Violet Peters, in the choir, spews out a big sneeze, and Mr. White's toupee flies off, landing in front of the choir in full view. They keep on singing. Mr. White tries to look inconspicuous on the way back to the pew while he picks up his toupee and replaces it. It is time for the sermon. It is about fall and the coming harvest. Others are thinking about Halloween, what type of candy we should buy, or should they give out healthy snacks? Mrs. Ambrose is trying to unstick the keys in the organ by sticking her nail file in between them. No such luck. She accidentally knocks over a glass of water on the organ and drowns it. The organ shorts out a bit. At the very same time, a small bee alights from her flower bouquet and stings her on the nose, and her nose starts blowing up like a balloon. Someone turns the ceiling fan on because it has gotten hotter in the church. Women are complaining their hair is flying all over the place. The service is ending with the last hymn. A buzzing noise starts to sound from the organ. Then a trail of smoke appears, and it makes a queer sound and then dies. Pastor Johnson and some of the men check out the organ after church and decide the thing to do is call a repairman on Monday. Then everyone heads up to the coffee hour after church. Poor Mrs. Ambrose. Now she's got a dead organ.
Oh, what next? Oh, what else can happen to that poor woman?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, boy. Well, I would like to read a poem by Guy Wetmore Carroll entitled "The Embarrassing Episode of Little Miss Muffet." Guy Wetmore Carroll was a 19th century American poet and writer who was famous for parodying nursery rhymes and children's stories in cynical and witty modes. Carroll was born in 1873 and died in 1904. Let's see. His humorous poems usually end with a pun on the words used in the moral of the story. So, here is the embarrassing episode of Little Miss Muffet. Little Miss Muffet discovered a tuffet, which never occurred to the rest of us, and as 'twas a June day and just about noonday, she wanted to eat like the best of us. Her diet was whey, and I hasten to say it is wholesome and people grow fat on it. The spot being lonely, the lady not only discovered the tuffet, but sat on it. A rivulet gabbled beside her and babbled, as rivulets always are thought to do, and dragonflies sported around and cavorted, as poets say dragonflies ought to do. When, glancing aside for a moment, she spied a horrible sight that brought fear to her. A hideous spider was sitting beside her and most unavoidably near to her. Albeit unsightly, this creature politely said, "Madam, I earnestly vow to you, I'm penitent that I did not bring my hat. I should otherwise certainly bow to you." Though anxious to please, he was so ill at ease that he lost all his sense of propriety and grew so inept that he clumsily stepped in her plate, which is barred in society.
Uh-oh.
This curious error completed her terror. She shuddered and, growing much paler, not only left Tuffet, but dealt him a buffet which doubled him up in a sailor knot. It should be explained that at this he was pained.
Uh-oh.
He cried, "I have vexed you, no doubt of it. Your fist's like a truncheon." "You're still in my luncheon," was all that she answered. "Get out of it." And the moral is this, be it madam or miss, to whom you have something to say, you are only absurd when you get in the curd, but you're rude when you get in the way.
No, oh my.
Oh, boy.
Oh, that's really good. That's funny. Really good.
Okay.
Very original. Okay. I've got two poems from William Blake, and one's called To Autumn, the other one's A Poison Tree, and there's some background information on him. And the dates are 1757 to 1827. Blake was a British poet, painter, and engraver who lived and worked in London. He spent a lot of time drawing Westminster Abbey. In early 1970, Blake became acquainted with the celebrated lady of fashion, Harriet Matthews, whose home was a favorite meeting place of artists and musicians. This is where Blake began his poetry and led to his first volume, Poetical Sketches, in which To Autumn was published, and only 50 copies were known to be in print. Later on, he married Harriet Matthews. Okay. And the first poem, To Autumn. O autumn, laden with fruit and stained with the blood of the grape, pass not, but sit beneath my shady roof. There thou mayest rest and tune thy jolly voice to my fresh pipe, and all the daughters of the year shall dance. Sing now the lusty song of fruits and flowers. The narrow bud opens her beauties to the sun, and love runs in her thrilling veins. Blossoms hang around the brow of morning and flourish down the light of modest eve, till clustering summer breaks forth into singing, and feathered clouds strew flowers around her head. The spirits of the air live in the smells of fruit and joy with pinions light, rose round the gardens or sits singing in the trees. Thus sang the jolly autumn as he sat, then rose, girded himself, and o'er the bleak hills fled from our sight, but left his golden load. Okay, the second poem's is Poison Tree. I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears, and I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night till it bore an apple bright, and my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole when in the night and veiled the pole. In the morning glad I see my foe outstretched beneath the tree. Oh, boy.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
wow.
Some ending.
Okay, moving on. This is the time of year when education is in the air. Kids going back to school, high school grads going off to college, young minds everywhere being stuffed with knowledge. But what about the adults? What are we doing to improve our minds? Well, here's Woody Allen with some excellent suggestions for adult continuing education. Let's see. A class on economic theory. A systematic application and critical evaluation of the basic analytic concepts of economic theory with an emphasis on money and why it's good. Fixed coefficient production functions, cost and supply curves, and non-convexivity comprise the first semester, with the second semester concentrating on spending, making change, and keeping a neat wallet. The Federal Reserve System is analyzed, and advanced students are coached in the proper method of filling out a deposit slip. Other topics include inflation and depression, how to dress for each, and you'll learn about loans, interest, and welching.
Nope.
Okay. Now, if you want to take a class on history of Western civilization, you'll learn the following. Ever since the discovery of a fossilized Eohippus in the men's washroom at Siddons Cafeteria in East Rutherford, New Jersey, it's been suspected that at one time Europe and America were connected by a strip of land that later sank or became East Rutherford, New Jersey, or both. This throws a new perspective on the formation of European society and enables historians to conjecture about why it sprang up in an area that would have made a much better Asia. Also studied in the course is the decision to hold the Renaissance in Italy. Okay, now, an introduction to psychology course is offered, and here's the description. The theory of human behavior, why some men are called lovely individuals, and why there are others you just want to pinch. Is there a split between mind and body? And if so, which is better to have? Aggression and rebellion are discussed. Students particularly interested in these aspects of psychology are advised to take one of these winter term courses, Introduction to Hostility, Intermediate Hostility, Advanced Hatred, and the Theoretical Foundations of Loathing. Special consideration is given to a study of consciousness as opposed to unconsciousness, with many helpful hints on how to remain conscious. Let's see. There's a class in psychopathology, and this class is aimed at understanding obsessions and phobias, including the fear of being suddenly captured and stuffed with crab meat, reluctance to return a volleyball serve, and the inability to say the word Mackinac in the presence of women. The compulsion to seek out the company of beavers is analyzed. Okay, and philosophy. Oh, there's some interesting stuff here. Philosophy 1, you'll get everyone from Plato to Camus, and the following topics are covered. Ethics, the categorical imperative and six ways to make it work for you. On aesthetics, is art the mirror of life or what? Metaphysics, what happens to the soul after death? How does it manage? And epistemology, is knowledge knowable? If not, how do we know this? And the absurd, why existence is often considered silly, particularly for men who wear brown and white shoes. Manyness and oneness are studied as they relate to otherness. Students achieving oneness will move ahead to two-ness. Oh, my goodness. And another philosophy class, this is numbered 24B, this is an introduction to God. Confrontation with the creator of the universe through informal lectures and field trips. Well, those are some fascinating topics, and I'm going to sign up for all of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think I need to take a few courses like that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I might want to go from oneness to two-ness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have two poems by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, and one's called Autumn Song and one's called Silent Noon. Rossetti was born May 12, 1828, and he died April 9th in 1882. He was an English poet. His work influenced the European symbolists, and he was a major supporter of the aesthetic movement. His poetry was characteristic of the linking of thought and feeling. So the first one is Autumn's Song here. Know'st thou not at the fall of the leaf how the heart feels a languid grief laid on it for a covering, and how sleep seems a goodly thing in autumn at the fall of the leaf, and how sweet the beat of the brain falters because it is in vain in autumn at the fall of the leaf, and how the chief of joy seems not to suffer pain. Know'st thou not at the fall of the leaf how the soul feels like a dried sheaf bound up at length for harvesting, and how death seems a comely thing in autumn at the fall of the leaf. And the second one, Silent Noon. Your hands lie open in the long fresh grass, the finger points loop through like rosy blooms, your eyes smile peace. The pasture gleams and glooms neath billowing skies that scatter and amass all around our nest as far as the eye can pass. Our golden kingcup fields with silver edge, where the cow parsley skirts the tree and the hawthorn hedge. 'Tis visible silence, still as the hourglass. Deep in the sun, search gross the dragonfly hangs like a blue thread loosened from the sky. So this winged hour is dropped to us from above. Oh, clasp me to our hearts, for death now dowers this close companion in inarticulate hour, when twofold silence was the song of love.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, well, from the sublime back to the ridiculous. This is a poem entitled The Little Old Lady in Lavender Silk, and it was written by Dorothy Parker. She is a 20th century American writer who is widely anthologized for short stories, poetry, and literary criticism. She was a legendary figure on the New York literary scene and a member of the famous Algonquin Round Table. She later wrote screenplays and helped found the Screenwriters Guild. Parker was born in 1893 and died in 1967. And here is The Little Old Lady in Lavender Silk. I was 77 come August. I shall shortly be losing my bloom. I've experienced zephyr and raw gust and symbolical flood and simoom. When you come to this time of abatement, to this passing from summer to fall, it's manners to issue a statement as to what you got out of it all. So I'll say, though reflection unnerves me and pronouncements I dodge as I can, that I think, if my memory serves me, there was nothing more fun than a man. In my youth, when the crescent was too wan to embarrass with beams from above, by the aid of some local Don Juan, I fell into the habit of love. And I learned how to kiss and be merry, an education left better unsung. My neglect of the waters Perean was a scandal when Grandma was young. Though the shabby unbalanced the splendid, and the bitter outmeasured the sweet, I should certainly do as I then did, were I given the chance to repeat. For contrition is hollow and wraithful, and regret is no part of my plan. And I think, if my memory's faithful, there was nothing more fun than a man.
She must have had a lot of boyfriends.
I guess she did. I guess she did. Okay.
Okay, I have a story by H.H. Monroe, and known more by the name of Saki. H.H. Monroe, or Hector U. Monroe, was born December 18th in 1870 and died November 14th, 1960. He's better known by the pen name Saki. He was a British writer. His short stories have said to be witty, mischievous, and sometimes macabre. They also satirize Edwardian society. And this one is called the Chartres Metterclue Method, and that's a method of teaching. Okay. Lady Carlotta stepped out onto the platform of the small wayside station and took a turn or two up and down its uninteresting length to kill time till the train should be pleased to proceed on its way. Then, in the roadway beyond, she saw a horse struggling with a more than ample load. in a carter of the sort that seemed to bear a sullen hatred against the animal that helped him to earn a living. Lady Carlotta promptly betook her to the roadway and put a rather different complexion on the struggle. Certain of her acquaintances were wont to give her plentiful admonition as to the undesirability of interfering on behalf of a distressed animal, such interferences being none of her business. Only once had she put the doctrine of no interference into practice, when one of its most eloquent exponents had been besieged for nearly 3 hours in a small and extremely uncomfortable maitrie by an angry boar pig. But Lady Carlotta, on the other side of the fence, had proceeded with the watercolor sketch she was engaged on, and refused to interfere between the boar and his prisoner. It is to be feared that she lost the friendship of the ultimately rescued lady. On this occasion, she merely lost the train, which gave way to the first sign of impatience it had shown throughout the journey, and steamed off without her. She bore the desertion with philosophical indifference. Her friends and relations were thoroughly well used to the fact her luggage arriving without her. She wired a vague, noncommittal message to her destination to say she was coming on by another train. But before she had time to think what her next move might be, she was confronted by an imposing, attired lady who seemed to be taking a prolonged mental inventory of her clothes and looks. "You must be Miss Hope, the governess I came to meet," she said. "I am Miss Carborough," continued the lady. "And where, pray, is your luggage?" "It's gone astray," she said. "I've telegraphed it about it," she said with a nearer approach to the truth. "How provoking," said Miss Carborough. "These railway companies are so careless. However, my maid can lend you things for the night," and she led the way to her car. During the drive to Carborough Mansion, Lady Carlotta was impressively introduced to the nature of the charge that she had been thrust upon her. She learned that Claude and Wilfred were delicate, sensitive young people, that Irene had the autistic temperament highly developed, and that Viola was something or other of a mold equally commonplace among children of that class and type in the 20th century. "I wish them only not to be taught," said Miss Carborough, "but interested in what they learn. In their history lessons, for example, you must try to make them feel that they are being introduced to the life stories of men and women who really live, not merely committing a mass of names and dates to memory. French, of course, I expect you to talk at mealtimes several days in the week." "I shall talk French 4 days of the week and Russian in the remaining three," she said. "Russian, my dear Miss Hope? No one in the house speaks Russian or understands Russian." "That will not embarrass me in the least," said Lady Carlotta coldly. "We've got very satisfactory references from you for Canon Teep," she observed. "A very estimable man, I should think." "Drinks like a fish and beats his wife. Otherwise a very lovable character," said the governess. "My dear Miss Hope, I trust you are exaggerating," exclaimed Carborough in unison. Mr. Carborough made a welcome diversion and asked the new instructress how she proposed to inaugurate on the morrow. "History to begin with," she informed him. "I've told her that," said Mrs. Carborough. "She says, I teach Schwartz Metterklum method," she said, the governess said loftily. "What are your children doing out here?" demanded Mrs. Carborough the next morning. I'm finding Irene sitting rather glumly at the head of the stairs, while her sister was perched in an attitude of depressed discomfort on the window seat behind her, with a wolfskin rug almost covering her. "We are having a history lesson," came the unexpected reply. "I am supposed to be Rome, and Viola up there is the she-wolf. Not a real wolf, but the figure of one that the Romans used to set store by. I forget why. Claude and Wilfred have gone to fetch the shabby women." "The shabby women?" "Yes, they've got to carry them off. Didn't want to, but Miss Hope got one of Father's 5 bats and said she'd give them a number 9 spanking if they didn't. So they've gone to do it." A loud, angry screaming from the direction of the lawn drew Mrs. Carborough thither in hot haste, fearful lest the threatening castination might not even be in progress of infliction. The outcry, however, came principally from the 2 small daughters of the lodgekeeper, who were being hauled and pushed towards the house by panting and disheveled Claude and Wilfred, whose task was rendered even more arduous by the insistent, if not very effectual, attacks of the captured maiden's small brother. The governess, 5 bats in hand, sat on the stone presiding over the scene with the cold impartiality of a goddess of battles. A furious and repeated chorus of "I'll tell Mulver" rode from the lodge children, but the lodge mother, who was hard of hearing, was for the moment immersed in the preoccupation of her wash tub. Mrs. Carbrell flew to the rescue of the struggling captives. "Wilfred, Claude, let those children go at once. Miss Hope, what on earth is the meaning of this scene?" "Early Roman history, the Sabine woman, don't you know? It's the Schwarz-Metterklum method to make children understand history by acting it out themselves. Fixes in their memory, you know. Of course, thanks to your interferences, your boy goes through life thinking that the Sabine woman ultimately escaped. I cannot really be responsible." "You may be very clever and modern, Miss Hope," said Mrs. Corbrell firmly, "but I should like you to leave here by the next train. Your luggage will be sent after you as soon as it arrives." And Lady Carlotta strode out of the Corbrell mansion. The advent of General Miss Hope, who had made a mistake as to the day on which she was due to arrive, caused a turmoil which that good lady was quite unused to inspiring. Obviously, the Carbrell family had been woefully befooled, but a certain amount of relief came with the knowledge. "How tiresome for you, dear Carlotta," said her hostess, when the overdue guest ultimately arrived. "How very tiresome, losing your train and having to stop overnight at a strange place." "Oh, dear, no," said Lady Carlotta. "Not at all tiresome for me."
Ooh.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
A little scammer.
I guess. Okay, moving on. Our comedy segment this week is brought to you by
Exact Extract. Do you have a nagging toothache but find it inconvenient to take time off from work? Does adding another expense along with credit card debt force you to continue toothache pain? You can now solve the problem yourself. You can purchase Exact Extract at your local store. Exact Extract is a kit designed to help you get rid of your pain permanently. Here's how it works. Exact Extract comes with something that looks like a switch. Just take this stick and run it in the area where your toothache occurs. When the swab turns purple, you have located the bad tooth, and now you can prepare to remove it. Just take the tweezers that comes with the kit and make the tooth go back and forth and sideways. Eventually, the tooth will loosen up enough to pull out. This will solve your problem, and you will be proud you are your own dentist. Kit available at nosuchthing.com.
And by Smart Mouth Toothpaste. Do you have trouble remembering where you live or your mother's name? Do you sometimes respond with comments about turtles when people around you are discussing toasters? Have you ever felt inadequate because you don't know where Chicago is, even though you live here? My friends, there is hope. Try Smart Mouth Toothpaste every day for 1 month and amaze yourself and your friends. You'll sound like you read books. You'll sound like you know stuff. You'll love the new you. Smart Mouth, the toothpaste for people who are not too bright. Okay, and now for the news. This just in from Chris Radio's entertainment correspondent, Calliope Knackwurst. Dick Wolf's Chicago franchises, Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, and Chicago Med, will soon be joined by Chicago Streets and San, which will feature the life and loves of the heroic men and women who pick up the trash on our streets and make sure that our sewers are flowing properly. In an upcoming episode, Streets and San Commissioner Donald Trump, played by Clint Eastwood, vows to make Chicago great again. This does not sit well with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, played by Justin Bieber, who insists Chicago is already great. As the tension between them escalates, they come to blows. An ambulance is dispatched from Firehouse 51 and transports them to Chicago Med, where they are examined by supervising ER nurse Hillary Clinton, played by Meryl Streep. Clinton is forced to make the most important decision of her life. Oh, what will she do? We don't know. Okay, and now that moment you've all been waiting for or possibly dreading, it's time for what we think are the world's worst jokes.
Doctor, doctor, my son swallowed a pen. What should I do?
Use a pencil instead.
Doctor, doctor, my wooden leg is giving me a lot of pain.
Why's that?
My wife keeps hitting me over the head with it.
Doctor, doctor, my hair is falling out. Can you give me something to keep it in?
Yes, a paper bag.
Doctor, doctor, I keep thinking I'm a billiard ball.
Well, get back in the queue.
Doctor, doctor, I've been turned into a hare.
Stop rabbiting about it.
Doctor, doctor, I keep thinking I'm a dog.
Well, get up on this couch and I'll examine you.
I can't. I'm not allowed on the furniture.
No. Doctor, doctor, can I have a second opinion?
Of course. Come back tomorrow.
Doctor, doctor, I feel like a window.
Where's the pain?
Doctor, doctor, will my measles be better by next Monday?
I don't want to make any rash promises.
What did one tonsil say to the other?
Get dressed. The doctor is taking us out.
Doctor, doctor, I keep thinking I'm a fruitcake.
What's got into you?
Flour, raisins, and cherries.
Oh, okay. Doctor, doctor, you've got to help me. I keep thinking I'm a bridge.
What's come over you?
So far, a truck, a motorcycle, and two cars.
Doctor, doctor, I keep hearing a ringing in my ears.
Where else did you expect to hear it?
Doctor, doctor, what's good for biting fingernails?
Very sharp teeth. Well, mercifully, that's all we have time for today. I'm Elena Banta.
And I'm Mary Muckle, coming to you from Chris Radio, your information station. Our producer has been Brian Hawkins. Tune in next week when we'll be back with new information, more fiction, and new jokes. We'd love to hear from you. Any writers or poets out there, send us your best stuff and we'll read it on the show. Stories should be no longer than 10 minutes. And please remember to keep it clean. Send all material to Brian Hawkins, Chris Radio, the Chicago Lighthouse, 1850 West Roosevelt Road, Chicago, Illinois, 60608. If you have feedback for us, please call Brian at 312-997-3687 or TTY312-666-8874. We'd like to leave you with some words of wisdom. When things don't go right, go left. This has been a world of possibilities. Thank you for listening.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. much more than I've never known. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.